Good morning. May it please the Court, Maura McKelvey on behalf of all of the appellants, but for Pawtucket Credit Union. I would ask at this point to reserve 2 minutes of rebuttal time.
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor. The appellants here in these consolidated appeals and petition are asking this Court to review the Rhode Island District Court's March 29, 2012 amended order. This amended order establishes a mandatory mediation program lacking time or cost limits without first determining that the Court's jurisdiction over the parties and the claims. This order also includes a stay that is applied by the District Court to enjoin the appellants from pursuing property rights through non-judicial foreclosures and evictions outside the litigation pending before the District Court. These appellants ask this Court to dissolve the injunction as the stay is being applied by the District Court and because it fails to comport with due process and or to comply with Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 65 and 52. We're also asking this Court to vacate or modify the amended order to require the District Court to establish jurisdiction over the claims and parties prior to entering the order on each case.
Is the common jurisdictional claim the standing claim?
Yes, Your Honor, that is one of the jurisdictional issues that we are raising in relation to the amended order. The amended order is also applied on a blanket basis without the Court first determining that the defendants in each case have actually been served.
Mm-hmm.
So there's also a personal jurisdiction issue as well. We're also asking the Court to vacate or modify the amended order such that the mediation program would have finite time and cost limits. The appellants in these cases certainly do not disagree that the District Court has broad inherent powers, but those powers are not infinite. And this particular amended order fails to comply with what this Court has previously articulated as the parameters within which a District Court can exercise its inherent powers. In particular, the District Court's use of its inherent powers cannot contradict applicable statutes or rules, must provide procedural fairness to the parties, must be exercised with restraint and discretion, and must also enhance the Court's processes, leading to the orderly and expeditious disposition of the cases pending before it. The appellants also recognize that a District Court can, in fact, establish a mediation program, even a mandatory mediation program. The issues that we have with this particular amended order and the program that it establishes is that it violates the appellant's due process rights as the stay is being applied as an injunction outside the litigation. It fails to acknowledge or comport with the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, in particular Rules 52 and 65. It also fails to allow the defendants who are named in these lawsuits, not necessarily served, it fails to allow these appellants to challenge the Court's jurisdiction, nor does the Court actually examine its own jurisdiction over the claims before it.
Counsel, in these hundreds of cases that are pending, I gather in virtually every one of them, the defendant has filed a motion to dismiss. Is that correct?
Prior to the Court consolidating and creating this docket, several of the defendants had filed motions to dismiss. Part of the amended order stay prohibits the defendants from filing any papers other than a notice of appearance. Therefore, the appellants have not had the opportunity to pursue any of the claims that they may raise in a motion to dismiss.
Okay, well, on the assumption that if all of these other, in all these other cases, similar motions to dismiss were filed, and again, there are hundreds of them, would it be your position that the Court would have to address all of those hundreds of motions to dismiss before it could decide whether it was appropriate to order all of these cases to go, and assuming they were denied, to go forward to mediation? Is it your position that all of those preliminary motions to dismiss should be addressed in one form or another?
Yes, Your Honor. To the extent that these motions to dismiss are raising subject matter jurisdictional issues, the Court must first determine whether it has the power to order a party to mediation. And in order to do that, it must make an affirmative determination that it actually has jurisdiction over the claims.
Well, in practical terms, does that mean that there would have to be a hearing, I guess, on one issue and, let's say, one series of generic issues? The one issue would be the standing issue with respect to the assignments. And I take it that would be a common issue for at least every defendant who might wish to raise it. And the plural but generic issues would be whether or not there was, in fact, service made. And are there any other dismissal issues other than those two?
We do have instances where the wrong party has named, where there is no basis to state a claim. I think certain other aspects, defenses that could be raised under 12b-6, but those would be...
Those are merits issues.
I'm sorry?
I mean, if a wrong party issue is a factual merit issue. You got the wrong person.
That's correct.
There is at least jurisdiction over that person long enough to allow for that merits defense to be raised.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So that particular kind of a defense could be raised before the master?
Potentially, Your Honor. I think that what you're suggesting...
Well, the person's going to say, look, master, I'm not going to settle because, you know, I'm not a party to a mortgage transaction here.
Well, Your Honor, indeed that has happened in some of these cases, but the problem is that those parties are still stuck in the mediation process. There's been no return of a case to the litigation following a determination that that is not a party who is an appropriate party to participate in the mediation. So what we have is a perpetual...
But doesn't that go to your issue that, in fact, the stay is so long, so open-ended, that it is a de facto injunction?
Yes, Your Honor, it does. Okay. In relation to these jurisdictional issues. The district court, however, has also applied its stay outside of the litigation. We have the stay being utilized by the district court as an injunction preventing these appellants from taking actions to pursue their property rights in a non-judicial foreclosure state, such as Rhode Island, where the actual foreclosure is not part of the lawsuit before the district court. The district court has issued orders stating that its stay prevents these appellants from pursuing a foreclosure action and from enforcing an eviction judgment that they received from the Rhode Island State Court. These issues, clearly, without providing any notice to the defendants that the court intended its stay to be applied as an injunction or an opportunity for these appellants to be heard as to the merits of whether these plaintiffs, these borrowers, are entitled to such injunctive relief, is a violation of the due process rights of the appellants and also fails to comply with Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 65. The district court is applying its injunction on a blanket basis. This is an order that is entered within days of the case being filed without confirmation of service over the defendants, without a confirmation of the court's jurisdiction over the claims themselves and the standing of the borrowers to bring these claims, as has been mentioned. But it also fails to do an evaluation of the merits of the injunctive relief being granted. The plaintiffs in many of these cases are not even asking for an injunction. This district court has entered a sua sponte injunction without even requiring the plaintiffs to present any evidence of the likelihood of success on the merits, the irreparable harm that they will sustain if they do not receive the injunctive relief, the balance of hardship that must tilt in their favor, or that this injunction will not negatively impact the public. The district court also has failed to provide any reasons for its application of its stay as an injunction in each and every case, failing to comply with Rule 52A2 and providing these appellants with any basis to pursue appellate relief when an injunction has been entered. These appellants did not learn, of course, of the district court's intention to apply the stay as an injunction until the plaintiffs moved for sanctions, claiming that going forward with the foreclosure sale after they had filed the lawsuit and the district court had applied its order was somehow in violation of the stay of the litigation. The appellants opposed this on the basis that a stay governs judicial proceedings, an injunction governs the actions of parties outside that proceeding. The district court, while denying the plaintiff's motion for sanctions because it was the first violation that the district court had reviewed, stated and clarified that its stay actually was meant to be an injunction by saying that it prevented the defendants from pursuing foreclosure activities as to any property that was the subject matter of a case pending before it.
Well, counsel, I mean, the district court does have a real problem here. I mean, there are a huge number of these lawsuits. What would be your sense of what might allow the district court to deal with this huge administrative problem and at the same time perhaps allow your clients to get some individual attention for their case? Can you suggest an approach that might address those two concerns, both of which arguably are very legitimate?
They are legitimate concerns, Your Honor. In the practical reality of the situation that we're faced with now. But I would point out that this docket has grown exponentially because of this district court's order. We have 700 cases that grew from 24 back in August of 2011 because of the way the court is applying its stay and because of this program.
Excuse me, you're suggesting that the court order itself encouraged the filing of these lawsuits? Do you think that is what has happened here?
I think that's a very accurate assessment of what we have seen happen. Certainly in a small jurisdiction such as Rhode Island, this is a phenomenal number of cases to be filed. Now, to answer your question as to what can be done, I think the threshold issue of standing needs to be determined. This issue was raised. It was evaluated by Magistrate Judge Martin, who issued a report and recommendation finding that the borrowers in two cases, the Frizell and the Cozadue matters, did not have standing to bring claims challenging these assignments of mortgage. The plaintiffs objected to the report and recommendation, and soon after the district court took over these files and created this docket, the district court held a hearing. We argued, addressed the issues raised in the objection. Unfortunately, we've never received a ruling on whether or not the report and recommendation will be adopted or rejected by the district court.
So there was a hearing on this alleged standing issue?
Correct, Your Honor.
Was there a hearing on the service issue, service of process?
No. Okay. And part of the due process issue and the lack of notice is that when the district court issued this amended order, these appellants did not have an understanding of how the district court intended it to be applied. The meetings that the district court refers to as having provided us with some meaningful opportunity to be heard, simply we did not have notice that this is what the district court intended to do, number one. And number two, all of the cases after the initial 24 had no opportunity to raise any issues with respect to whether or not the stay should be applied as it is by the court as an injunction, nor did they have an opportunity to raise any jurisdictional issues.
Are you saying that the 676 additional cases, there have not been motions to dismiss for lack of standing filed?
We are not prohibited to file any motions, Your Honor, in this docket, just notices of appearance. So unfortunately, none of the merits, none of the substantive issues that could make a determination as to whether a case should be before the court and whether it should be a part of the mandatory mediation program have been addressed. This amended order is also problematic from the appellant's perspective because there's no limit in time and there's no cap on the costs that can be incurred. Thus far, we've been in this mediation program since January of 2012. 697 cases are pending. Only 155 have had any type of mediation. And of those 155, there's been only one case that's actually resulted for a mediation has resulted in a stipulation of dismissal. We are not seeing any progress in terms of this mediation program actually leading to the expeditious and orderly disposition of these cases, and it is costing the parties involved, certainly so far, $323,000. We would submit to this court that because of these various defects and procedural issues, due process violations, failure to acknowledge state and federal law, and most importantly, a lack of due process rights to the parties being enjoined by the district court, that the court should vacate this order and certainly should dissolve the injunction.
Counsel, I wonder if you would just briefly address the timeliness of the appeal issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
It does appear that this, I believe this March 29th order, which I think is the order appealed from, it's for the most part, it seems to be a slight refinement of earlier orders involving mediation. So if that's a fair characterization, why isn't there a legitimate argument that your appeal is simply not timely?
Well, the timing aspect and what really plays into the lack of due process, as I mentioned previously, is that the district court never articulated that its stay was going to be applied as an injunction outside the litigation until March of 2012. At that point, the plaintiffs moved for sanctions, claiming that the appellants had violated the stay by moving forward with a non-judicial foreclosure. When the district court issued its order denying the motion but clarifying what he meant by the stay, at that moment we received confirmation for the very first time.
That was a March 21 order. March 21 order. Excuse me, was it not?
Yes, Your Honor. The other basis, however, to the extent that the notice of appeal is as to the large consolidated group were to be determined somehow late, we have cases such as the individual four appeals that have been consolidated with this matter where we have filed our notice of appeal within 30 days of entry of the amended order on the docket of that case or within 30 days of service of process on that defendant. The Gamino case in particular, there's no issue, I think, Your Honor, as to timeliness because essentially the amended order was entered and we filed a notice of appeal. But I do think that because we did not have any understanding, we asked for it. We asked for clarification of the district court's order on February 2nd within 30 days of the appointment of the special master. And one of the areas we asked for clarification was what did the court mean by the stay? The court provided us with simply no information on that front. It was a text order that was about a paragraph long, and it simply reiterated that its stay remained in effect as to all matters. So the parties had no opportunity to assess the intention or the implications of a stay when the court planned in the future date to apply it as an injunction until the court articulated in its order in the Cook case that, in fact, its stay prevented the appellants from taking actions outside of the district court's litigation.
Counsel, you've asked us to vacate and to dissolve what you've termed an injunction. So correct me if I'm wrong. That would result in the lending institutions or the foreclosing parties to go forward in several hundred cases with foreclosures if that's what they choose to do. So in the meantime, if the district court were to determine that there is standing and were to determine that there is a likelihood of success on the merits, the cases could all end up back in the district court? Is that how it's going to work?
Your Honor, I believe that that is a possibility. Certainly if the plaintiffs were to seek injunctive relief at the outset, were to establish their burden of proving a right to that relief, if the court were to apply Rule 65 and to give the appellants due process, yes, I think that we would end up with the parties being provided with the procedural due process to which they're entitled as litigants. But that would be the result, ultimately, of dissolving the injunction. They would have the option to pursue that relief, yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
I was going to say, is there any reason at this point that if we were basically to see the merits your way, we could not remand, let's say, for vacating of the injunction after holding merits hearings on the jurisdictional issues and the service issues? In other words, can instead of dissolving the injunction, which is what you ask for, could we order an expeditious hearing on the jurisdictional issues after which the court could make jurisdictional rulings?
Well, the jurisdictional piece certainly needs to be addressed, Your Honor, but I view the injunction to be separate. It's an extraordinary relief.
Well, if there's no jurisdiction, there's no injunction. If there is jurisdiction, then at least there is jurisdiction for for some, let's say, reasonable time, much less than you claim has been consumed here, to address the other issues. Isn't that so? I mean, we as just LaPelle said, we've got to take into consideration, or the district court has got to take into consideration, the volume that there is that is facing the court now.
I understand that there are serious constraints in terms of the caseload that's been created through this program. I do understand what you're saying is that if we were to have a determination as to jurisdiction, then the court could address the merits of the injunction. But due process is such a fundamental right. It is actually the right to notice and an opportunity to be heard before a party is enjoined is one of the hallmarks of our judicial process. And I think that to keep that in place without having made any determination by this district court that these plaintiffs are entitled to this relief on the merits, I don't see that this is legally permissive, Your Honor. I think I'm over time. Thank you.
You've reserved a couple of minutes. The time that's been allotted to you, counsel, for this morning only, you should consider a guideline and not a hard stop.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Mark LaDove on behalf of the Brennan Center for Justice and our fellow amici, Rhode Island Legal Services, the National Consumer Law Center, DARE, and the Housing Network of Rhode Island, and I'd like to thank the appellees counsel for ceding some of their time to us this morning. We are here to urge the court to affirm the case management order of March 29th in its entirety. I would like to start by explaining briefly three points why we believe the case management order is not an abuse of discretion and is an appropriate use of the court's inherent authority. First of all, the court has inherent authority to stay litigation, to appoint
it. It does if it has jurisdiction. If there is a colorable jurisdictional issue, why doesn't that come first?
Your Honor, I think that the appellants are conflating subject matter jurisdiction with the merits here. All of their claims about standing go to the merits of the case. They don't go
standing can almost always be recast as a merits issue, but standing in a strict sense is a jurisdictional issue, isn't it?
Well, but Your Honor, this is a case where not here, I believe, Your Honor, respectfully. This is a docket where, I understand your question, obviously, but these plaintiffs do have standing as homeowners to contest whether or not these defendants are foreclosing on them properly. They have an injury, they have a legal cause of action, and they have a potential remedy. So for constitutional Article III purposes, there is certainly standing here.
Well, are you saying, in effect, then, we should regard the standing issue as non-jurisdictional because it's essentially frivolous?
I'm not saying that, Your Honor, but what I am saying is that
if it's not frivolous, why doesn't the standing issue require litigation to begin with? If it doesn't require litigation, can that be true on any other ground than it is patently frivolous?
Well, I see this, Your Honor, as a 12b6 merits question, and I do, certainly, if the district court had any reason to believe that it lacked subject matter jurisdiction over these cases, absolutely, the court would have an obligation sua sponte to review this and to potentially dismiss before mediation. But that's not the case here, Your Honor. The court has subject matter jurisdiction over these cases. The Friesel report and recommendation.
You are saying then, mm-hmm. I think you're saying that in fact the jurisdictional claim, as a jurisdictional claim, is frivolous.
Yes, I would agree with that, and I would say that it's inappropriate really to address the merits of the cases in this courtroom at this moment before the district court has had an opportunity to rule. I don't think that the merits are properly before the Court of Appeals yet. And I would agree that the subject matter jurisdiction question doesn't need to be resolved because there really isn't an issue there.
Counsel, we've been told that the magistrate judge addressed at least a couple of the motions to dismiss on subject matters jurisdiction grounds on standing issues and recommended to the district court that those motions be granted, and yet the district court has never addressed it. Was the Was that a standing analysis that was done by the magistrate judge? Is that the nature of the issues before?
No, Your Honor, it's important to distinguish between standing and subject matter jurisdiction, which the magistrate did there. And we cite this in our brief. It's in a footnote in the magistrate's report and recommendation. The magistrate said, the motion to dismiss has been presented to me as a 12B1. There is subject matter jurisdiction. It cited the Fifth Circuit, but it's consistent certainly with the Supreme Court's set of rulings, Arbaugh and other cases, trying to explain a clear distinction between jurisdictional questions and merits questions. And what the magistrate said was, there is jurisdiction, there's subject matter jurisdiction. The court then went on to address the standing question as a merits issue. We would respectfully disagree with the merits analysis, but again, that question is not before the court right now. The question would be the subject matter jurisdiction, and the magistrate did find subject matter jurisdiction. I think the appellants in their briefing have tried to conflate those two questions, but the magistrate clearly drew that distinction in a way that I think should be recognized by the court.
Can you just very briefly, because I know you have other issues to address, I mean, as you understand, what is the nature of the lack of standing argument, whether you want to characterize it as a subject matter jurisdiction or a merits argument? Is it that these the homeowners, the mortgagors, have no standing to challenge the assignment because of the very terms of the mortgage instruments that they signed? Is that essentially the argument?
Well, right. I mean, again, I will certainly answer the question. I would point out that I don't believe that question is one that the court should be addressing at the stage before the district court has. I do believe that the dispute turns on whether or not the homeowner has standing to challenge an assignment of the mortgage. We believe that the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court's approach to this question is the proper one, which is to say that a homeowner plainly has standing to challenge whether the foreclosure of their home was proper. If the homeowner believed that there was a break in the chain of title at some point, such that the party of interest claiming to own the loan at the moment of the foreclosure is not the true party of interest, then certainly they have standing to address that issue, and then whether or not the claim succeeds or fails is a fact-specific matter that the district court needs to address.
Well, thank you.
Sure. I guess one other thing that I would like to point out that was raised by some of the questions before is this question of what would be the proper procedure. I would urge the court to look at the district court's January 7th, 2013 order, which was introduced into the record by the appellants about 2 weeks ago through their motion to expand the record. The district court has set out a process to address these case-specific questions. The district court has announced a process whereby any specific party who believes that they are not the right party in interest. The court mentions res judicata or collateral estoppel, which would be presumably claims you could raise if there was a state court judgment that you were concerned about, which is something in the briefs. The district court says if you have that kind of a case-specific claim, that you can raise that issue with the special master, and the special master will make a recommendation, and you can then review. The court would either review it as an appellate or take that recommendation under consideration.
The special master is not a lawyer. Is that correct?
She is a lawyer, but she's a lawyer. She is the former chairman of the Bank of Rhode Island. I guess my point is that the district court certainly has a procedure in place to review these kinds of case-specific questions. And again, that process is underway. It is an efficient and equitable attempt to manage, as you pointed out, an enormous docket of cases. And I think that process has to be given a chance to succeed in the district court before it's properly before this court on appeal.
But before you get to that, whether it's posed as standing or likelihood of success on the merits, isn't it true that the orders below and the proceedings below, the conduct of the litigation so far, really has resulted in enjoining the institutions from taking actions outside of the litigation that they would otherwise be free to take? And doesn't there at least have to be a hearing on likelihood of success before you can get into this other stuff?
Well,
because you've got an injunction that didn't do the four-part test.
Well, I guess I would respectfully disagree with the construction of the stay order as an injunction. I actually think it's worth looking at the appellant's brief on this. In footnote 6, where they talk about timeliness, which you asked about earlier, Your Honor, the appellants concede that the earlier two case management orders were a stay of proceedings, but they then claim that this March 29th order became an injunction. as Your Honor pointed out, what they're referring to is this intermediate order in a very specific case where the court talked about a conflict between the parties over what it meant to be subject to the stay and to good faith negotiations. If the appellants, if a party has the belief that they are being enjoined improperly, then they need to address that issue in that specific case and based on that specific order. But none of those cases...
So when counsel said that the 600-plus cases that have come in after they are not allowed to file anything, that's incorrect?
As of the January 7th order, the January 7th, 2013 order, the court has said that it will hear case-specific motions addressing whether or not a party is properly before the court. The court has said in that order that it's not going to deal with some of these global issues, which I think could unravel a process that is equitable and efficient and working to the good of hundreds of parties who are not here before the court. So there is a process to address these case-specific issues, and we believe that that has to have an opportunity to succeed in the first instance.
What case-specific issues do you understand the court to cover? Any issues beyond failure to make service?
Well, the court also mentions whether a party is the right party in interest to be before the court, and the court specifically mentions in its order, and I should say that the court order doesn't claim that the list is meant to be comprehensive, but the court mentions res judicata and collateral estoppel, which would be issues that might occur if there was a prior proceeding that had been underway or reached a judgment and in a manner in which the court believed would be controlling.
Do you also understand that the case-specific issues would not include an objection to the injunction so far as it enjoined non-judicial foreclosure proceedings for parties that subsequently joined after the 24?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that I guess I can't say without seeing how the order plays out in practice, but I think that that would need to be a case-specific question that would have to be raised by those parties. I mean, again, there one of the things that...
Case-specific, the question can be raised specifically in every case, but it's essentially a generic issue with respect to any Rhode Island mortgage.
Well, with respect, I don't see it as a generic issue because I think that there are hundreds of cases where that are not part of this appeal. The special master's reports show that there are plenty of parties who are negotiating in good faith before the special master. I would respectfully disagree with the appellants.
What's that got to do with those who are objecting to being there? So
well,
what?
I believe that to the extent that they are objecting to being in the litigation, I don't think that that's a proper objection. To the extent that they're objecting to having the litigation stayed and having the mediation, I believe the appellants conceded that the court has that inherent authority. To the extent that a party believes that it is being enjoined and not stayed, I believe that that party has to address that issue in a specific case based on a specific ruling by the court that it objects to, and that would create an appropriate issue for appeal. I think that it's impossible to look at the briefs and the record here and really see how that is working in any specific case because of the fact that they're appealing this March 29th case management order, we believe inappropriately, rather than addressing this issue in a specific case. I see my time is up, but the part of what I did also want to make sure to convey here is that we believe that the court has used its inherent authority properly, and it's used it equitably and efficiently. The program that has been created is based on best practices around the country. It's based on practices that are working to keep people in their homes and also to get lenders loan modifications which are better for the loan investors than a foreclosure would be. And so the process that is underway is not just within the inherent authority of the court, but it is a better and more equitable way to resolve these cases than the kind of litigation that would be threatened if this process was to
counsel,
be dismantled.
Your opposing counsel, I believe I understood her to suggest that at the time that the court first entered this order, there was, compared to the number now, a relatively small number of these cases on the docket. In the wake of the court entering this order, you now have hundreds of cases that have been filed, and because of the nature of this order, without any review of those cases, any individualized review of those cases, all of those cases are swept into this mediation regime, and the defendants have to participate in mediation. Do you agree with that that's what's happened in the wake of this order?
I mean, I don't dispute the numbers that are in the record. I can't speak to cause and effect, Your Honor. I do think that there are, again, hundreds of parties and hundreds of cases not part of this appeal, and the record, the special master's report, shows that there are plenty of individual homeowners as well as plenty of banks, including, say, for example, Bank of America, that has indicated to the court that it did not want to participate in the appeal, as I understand it. That's mentioned in the district court's ruling on the request to stay. There are a lot of parties that are participating in mediation as a better way to resolve these legal claims than litigation. And so, and again, given the size of the docket, given the equities involved, given the nature of the foreclosure as an equitable issue, we think that it's inappropriate. And
I'm not saying this is necessarily a bad thing, but don't we have a situation where a homeowner facing a potential default situation, possibility of foreclosure, could receive advice of counsel, look, all you have to do is go into federal court and file a lawsuit challenging the bank's, the assignment from the initial lender. All you have to do is file a pleading, and immediately the bank is going to be required to enter into settlement negotiations with you, and you might get a break on the term. You might get a modification of your loan. I mean, isn't that the situation that we have now? That would be perfectly sensible legal advice, would it not?
Well, but I guess I'd want to add a few facts to that scenario. I mean, one is that the lenders do have an obligation. This is under traditional equitable principles, but also under a variety of rules and regulations that govern contemporary mortgage servicing. They do have an obligation to review and determine whether a homeowner is eligible for a loan modification that would be better for the bank as well as better for that homeowner, and obviously better for the communities that are suffering from the foreclosure crisis. So I do believe that there is that obligation. If the parties are in court mediating before in mediation before the special master, if there's an opportunity to reach that agreement, and it's an opportunity that can be achieved through mediation that, you know, should have perhaps been achieved prior and wasn't, then I don't think that there's any prejudice to the parties. At worst, there's a delay while the court is collecting use and occupancy payments, which would adhere to the bank's interest. In addition, the court has been aggressive about requiring the homeowners to pay use and occupancy and make other showings of as a condition of negotiating in good faith. So I don't see any prejudice to the banks, and I see a lot of benefits from the process. So I think that would be where we would stand. I'm well over time, and so I'm happy to answer other questions, but I also want to cede the microphone to Appellee's counsel. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Corey Allard for the Appellees. First, I would like to start off by addressing some of the issues raised by this panel. First and foremost is the fact that it's been brought up that the appellants don't have an opportunity to make any filings in the district court. That's not true. I urge this court to review the master docket, and what you will find is that very early on in the process, appellants or various other defendants have filed motions for relief from the stay based on both jurisdictional issues and the fact that these cases don't fit into the type of cases that are included in the settlement program.
Have those motions been ruled upon?
They were ruled upon, and on many of those motions, the motion for relief from the stay had been granted. There have also been motions by various appellees, plaintiffs, for relief from the stay, whereas they seek to mitigate the damages of the defendant banks and allow them to go forward with the foreclosure process and to sell the properties.
Has there been any ruling by the district court as opposed to the master on the so-called standing jurisdictional issue?
There has not, Your Honor. The closest regarding standing was the Frizzell report and recommendations recommended by Magistrate Judge Martin. That has never been adopted. It's like it never existed. I also would like to address the issue regarding the stay. The stay is an integral part to the settlement process. There's a big difference between the workout options available to my clients with regards to whether they were foreclosed upon or not foreclosed upon. If a property hasn't been foreclosed upon, they're looking at a cash for keys or a cash damages settlement. If the property hasn't been foreclosed on, they're able to keep the property and modify or work out the mortgage. There's a big difference between foreclosed upon and not foreclosed upon. So therefore, the stay is an integral part in allowing this process to work. And it's not an injunction because the appellant's rights aren't permanently taken away.
Well, they've been taken away for 13 months so far, and there's no end in sight.
And there's recourse for that. If the
Being
settlement
what?
Process doesn't work out, then they get kicked out, the stay is lifted, they're able to proceed towards foreclosure and eviction.
Is this being done on an individual case basis?
It is, Your Honor. It's a case-by-case analysis.
No, up to this point, have individual cases been released from the terms of the stay because the negotiation process was not working out?
Not yet, Your Honor, because the fact is that in many of the cases, the process has been working out. Ms. McKelvey's mistaken that only one case has produced a settlement stipulation. There have been numerous cases that have resulted in a settlement stipulation. If this panel reviews the master docket, they'll see that. And the terms of these settlements are such that people keep their property. Judge McConnell and the district court, in their wisdom, realized that people's rights are affected in these cases. If there's no stay, the property can be foreclosed on. These people can be evicted before their claims are even heard by the court, before the issue ever comes to trial. By that time, these people are broken. By that time, these people are destroyed. Their property rights are annihilated. I also want to address the issue that the appellants are concerned about the limitation on cost and time in the open-endedness regards to this day. If the defendants and appellants came to the table and eased their investor guidelines and broadened what they could do with regards to settlement, this process would move so much faster and these cases would be settled. There are a number of appellants that have done that and the cases have been settled. The only restriction on the settlement process is what the appellants are willing to do in regards to working these cases out. And with regards to
just to return to a question that Justice Souter raised earlier, I mean, do you acknowledge that there may well be a colorable jurisdictional argument that the defendants have raised here?
There may be a jurisdictional argument that the defendants have raised, but Judge McConnell's also provided a mechanism. There's a mechanism in district court for those jurisdictional issues to be resolved. And for the majority
being,
of the
being
team...
Being what?
Filing a motion for relief from the state with regards to the jurisdictional issues.
Has he announced that he will entertain such a motion?
There has the... As I stated earlier... In cases in the very early part of the process, those issues were entertained.
And have they been resolved?
Yes, they've been resolved. Those motions for relief from the state have been granted. With regards to...
On the jurisdictional issue?
On jurisdictional issues.
All right.
On January 13, Judge McConnell issued a supplement to the case management order, allowing for the defendants to raise those issues as well.
I don't have the 13 order in front of me. I thought the 13 order was only on case specific issues, and I take it this this standing jurisdictional issue is common, if not to all, at least to a huge number of or a huge proportion of these cases. So I'm not sure if I'm correct about the terms of the latest order. It seems uncertain that it covers the basic jurisdictional question that they want to raise.
Well, the standing issue has never been ruled upon, nor has there been a...
Excuse me, I thought you told me, I'm not following you then, because I thought you told me a moment ago that that some of the standing jurisdictional issues were considered, and the result of that consideration was to lift the stay to some parties.
Well, in that regard, I misspoke with regards to standing, but there are other jurisdictions.
Maybe I misremembered.
But there are other jurisdictional issues that have been ruled upon. Standing has never been ruled upon, nor has there ever been a statutory analysis with regards to standing.
All right. Doesn't that standing issue, regardless of what its merits may ultimately be, necessarily require some disposition before a stay goes on for 13 months and still counting?
Well, I think that these are extraordinary circumstances, in that the foreclosure problem in this country is so vast that sometimes the court needs to use their inherent power to take measures to be able to deal with the vastness of the problem. And I think that the district court did that in this case. Thank you.
I have a few very brief comments, and if the court has any further questions. The first thing that I want to clarify, and I think Justice Souter absolutely correctly stated what the January 7, 2013 order from the district court actually says. It specifically prohibits the issue, the global issue that has been raised and can be raised or should be raised in relation to all of these cases from being addressed, from being raised by the appellants or defendants in these cases. It makes reference to other jurisdictional issues, res judicata, collateral estoppel, and allows that a letter can be sent to the special master, who will then determine whether the district court will issue any kind of ruling. The special master is not an attorney at the present time. Prior to taking over as the bank of Rhode Island president and in her role there, she did have a law degree in practice law, is my understanding, but she is not currently a lawyer. So the order, we believe, clarifies that the district court is picking and choosing which issues, jurisdictional issues, that it will decide prior to requiring these appellants to participate in a mandatory mediation program. And this is a direct violation of our due process rights and certainly fails to address the threshold issue.
Excuse me, standing issues, is what's contemplated the master will hear those issues and make a recommendation to the district court? Is that what's contemplated?
What is stated in the order, Your Honor, I believe, is that a letter is to be sent to the special master, and then the special master will make a determination. No reference to the availability of a hearing on the issue has been referenced in that order, as I understand it. The other issue that I wanted to briefly address is that, unfortunately here, as much as we are all cognizant of the vast number of cases and indeed the problems with foreclosure in this country, the ends simply do not justify the means. And a district court judge cannot utilize its broad inherent powers in violation of federal rules and statutes and certainly without regard to parties' procedural due process rights. Ultimately, if the Rhode Island General Assembly wanted to establish a mediation program prior to mortgage holders being able to pursue a foreclosure, that it could do. The district court cannot legislate from the bench. Based on everything that we've previously presented, the appellants would again request that this court dissolve the injunction, or the stay as it's being applied as an injunction, and vacate or modify the amended order. Thank you very much.